Good morning. This is Talking Animals. Great to be with you again. The show was preempted last week for the finale of the Fun Drive, while the Wednesday before was devoted to our Fun Drive show. Thanks to all who supported Talking Animals as we made our goal and traveled well beyond. My guest today will be Jack Murphy, co-founder and director of Colorado-based Urban Wildlife Rescue, Inc. We'll speak with him in a few minutes. Later in the program, we'll have a brief chat with Julie Watkins of The Girls Gone Green about the No Meat March effort underway in conjunction with Florida Voices for Animals, including a local screening March 23rd of Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home. Great documentary. Also is the prize for Name of That Animal Tune. A bit later on, we'll give away a pair of tickets to see Get the Lead Out, a Led Zeppelin tribute band performing March 16th at the Straz Center. Busy show today. Let's get to it. Kicking off the program with an animal tune highly relevant to our conversation presently with Jack Murphy. This is Pete Seeger with Raccoons Got a Bushy Tail here on Talking Animals.
Raccoon's got a bushy tail, possum tail goes bare. The rabbit's got no tail at all, just a little old bunch of hair. Raccoon is a mighty man, he rambles through the dark. You ought to see him hunt his den when he hears old Ranger bark. Possum up the simmon tree, raccoon on the ground. Raccoon says to possum, won't you shake them simmons down? Rabbit up the gum stump, coon in the holler. Possum in the tater patch, as fat as he can wallow. Raccoon's got a bushy tail, possum's tail goes bare. The rabbit's got no tail at all, just a little old bunch of hair.
All right. That was Pete Seeger with Raccoon's Got a Bushy Tail. I'm Duncan Strauss. This is Talking Animals, and my guest today, Jack Murphy, is co-founder and director of Colorado-based Urban Wildlife Rescue, Inc., who will speak with us about what to do and what not to do, really, when assorted wildlife turns up at your home or business. And we'll also, of course, discuss other related issues. So, with a reminder that we invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing us at dj@wmnf.org. Let's welcome Jack Murphy to Talking Animals. Good morning, Jack.
Morning, Duncan. How you doing?
Great. Thanks so much for joining us today on Talking Animals. And, of course, you're speaking to you from Colorado, so it's extra bright and earlier time, so I appreciate that all the more.
Oh, no problem.
So I feel like there's so much to cover that, you know, at the same time that we kind of need to start at the remedial level. So when we say Urban Wildlife Rescue, not necessarily referring at this point to the name of your organization here so much as the practice itself, what does that really mean in contrast to other forms of animal rescue?
Well, the thing is, like, we started out doing wildlife rehabilitation, taking care of animals that were orphaned and injured, wildlife that was orphaned and injured. And then, you know, as time went on, we began getting calls on animals that were basically, for lack of a better word, a nuisance. And so what basically has happened over the last maybe 50 to 60 years is that, you know, the way we build our cities, the environment is usually better than the habitat around it. And by that I mean, like, for instance, here in Colorado, we live in a high plains desert, but the city of Denver metropolitan area, people put in non-native grasses we call lawns. They put in non-native trees and bushes, artificial water sources. So we've basically created a big wetland in the middle of the desert, and the animals all want to live here just like we do. And so it's created a conflict with animals living where people live.
Sure. So it sounds like at least partially what sort of further defines urban wildlife rescue is the animals themselves. What I mean, I'm sure obviously it varies from you know, area to area, state to state, but let's just start at least obviously where you are. What kind of animals are we really talking about that typically, you know, involve the work that you do?
You know, it could be everything from, you know, squirrels to raccoons to foxes, coyotes, skunks, bats, you know, things like that. Then there's the different bird issues with pigeons and starlings and things like that. But for the most part, it's mammals. And right now, the biggie is skunks and squirrels.
I see.
Know, squirrels are pretty much a year-round.
And you know, I mean, what's interesting, I guess, about that, maybe for a lot of people listening, is for example, you know, where I live, there's a ton of squirrels around my house in and around that area. And I guess it would never occur to me to say, oh, well, I got to get rid of these guys.
Yet I
gather from what you've said that that's maybe top of the charts or near it as far as the kind of calls or, you know, help that you get, you know, that people are seeking from you.
Well, yeah, I do get the calls where people just want, you know, the old, you need to come out and thin out the squirrels, you know, because there's too many of them. You get that. But a lot of times it's, you know, basically like animals that have gotten into people's houses. Like, I believe that people need to learn to coexist with the wildlife, but cohabitate, that's a whole different ballgame, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So if the animals are living in your roof or they're living under your porch, then you start getting into the animals getting a little too close. And so that's what happens a lot of times, is that the animals have taken residence in the attic or underneath the shed in the backyard, things like that.
Okay, so now, beyond just more, you know, as a generic term, urban wildlife rescue, let's talk more about urban wildlife rescue, as in this case, as it does pertain to your organization, because one of the things I think is really important to get into, especially after we just talked about squirrels and, you know, people getting too, animals getting too close to the house, is that, you know, seems like a real emphasis that you and colleagues elsewhere across the country place on doing this and helping solve those problems, but that does not mean those animals have to, you know, die or you know, be trapped or otherwise injured along the way.
Right. Well, that's, you know, I consider myself and a few of us, there's a handful of us across the country that are doing what I consider to be kind of like the new version or the modern version of wildlife control, which is non-lethal, doesn't involve trapping. I view most of the wildlife control we have now stems from the trapping background. I mean, trappers used to trap for fur, and then once we became more of an urban society than a rural society, the trappers began to realize that, geez, instead of walking along the creek for 20 miles, I can just go down the street and catch a couple of nuisance animals, skin them, and sell the pelt, and they make money on both ends. They make money from the homeowner for catching the animal, then they make money by selling the pelt. And so that's kind of how the business began to evolve.
Mm-hmm.
So now there are guys that strictly are, they just do wildlife control, and the methods they use, in my opinion, are antiquated methods. I mean, look at all the modern things that we've come up with in the last 100 years, you know, whether it's, you know, the automobile, the cell phone, the computer, but we still treat animals the same way we did back in the 1800s. We just go out and trap them. And there's way better ways that are more biologically sound and definitely not cruel. That can't be done. But that's, you know, a lot of guys balk at wanting to do that kind of stuff because they make more money by trapping.
And so if someone, you know, didn't have the privilege of knowing about you or maybe, you know, hearing the show today, and let's say back to how we just touched on it earlier, let's say all of a sudden there was too many squirrels or the squirrels were actually inside the house or a raccoon or whatever it might be. Now, if they, you know, go on the internet or talk to a buddy down the street or whatever, I mean, will it be clear to them, you know, what sort of method people are going to use, or is part of it that the idea is to not make it clear so that, because it just sounds like right what you just described, there's sort of a double dipping financially for some of these people, right? I mean,
yeah, it's... Well, okay, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, it sounds like, you know, as you mentioned, you know, they get paid by you or me or whoever to eradicate the animal, and then, you know, more unseemly even than that is that, you know, the animals are killed, and then further more unseemly is that they're often, you know, skinned for their pelts.
Yeah, some animals are, and some guys don't do that, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, the trappers, and they like to be called wildlife control operators, because trapper is kind of a different term. But, you know, the wildlife control operators run the gamut. You get the guys that do nothing but relocate. You get the guys that do nothing but kill. And then you get the guys in between. Some guys like squirrels, so they don't kill them, but they hate foxes, so they kill those. And kind of runs the gamut there. And it's up to the trapper. Once that guy's got an animal in a trap and he leaves your house, you have no knowledge or control over what he's going to do with it.
Right.
You know,
and you might not know enough even to ask about it or think about it, because you're just, you know, a lot of people would say, oh, thank goodness the problem is solved, but not think, you know, a step or two down the road.
Well, a lot of people are very naive to it. I know back when my wife and I first started doing this back in the late 80s, early 90s, we thought that the trappers would just come out and catch the animal very nicely and take it out and let it go. And we very quickly realized that that didn't happen. That's how I got into the business. I figured since you can't beat them, I might as well join them and do it right. You know?
Sure.
And it's just, plus we know now from science that any animal that's relocated has a greatly, greatly reduced chance of survival. So relocation is not good. And then, of course, biologically, when you're moving animals around, you could be spreading disease. You're taking an animal out of its habitat, putting it into another animal's habitat. The survival rate is really bad. So relocation is not good neither. It's just really bad science. And a lot of these guys, they don't like, well, I call it selective science. They like to take the science that fits their agenda and they toss the rest out the window. And that's what we see in this industry.
Right. And it also sounds like there's some pretty clever euphemisms involved with this wildlife control operators. That sounds like somebody spent some time really coming up with a very creative term for something that's a little darker, maybe a lot darker than it sounds at first blush. But so basically then, is part of the problem that again, a lot of us wouldn't know enough to ask the kind of questions if we did have that problem, but is also a related problem that sounds like it's pretty free form and unregulated. Are there regulations or laws that would sort of govern how the wildlife control operators do conduct a certain kind of operation? Or,
well, the regulations vary from state to state. Here, okay, in the state of Colorado, no regulations whatsoever. If you're going to use poisons or chemicals, you have to have a license to the Department of Agriculture. If you're just going to go out and trap, then all you need to do is go out and buy a trap, slap a sign on your truck, and you're in business. No regulations whatsoever. And even in the states where there are regulations, I remember it was a few years ago on one of the trapping websites, one of the guys was really proud of his wife because he said that he felt bad because he was telling all of his customers when they said, well, what are you going to do with the animals? And he would say that he takes them out to the country and lets them go. And he said he felt bad about that because he was killing everything. Mm. And so he came home from work one day and out in his shop, his wife had taken a big sign and said, welcome to the country. And she had it right up above his CO2 chamber where he killed the animals. Mm. And everybody just thought that was hilarious. So he was taking the animals to the country, but it was actually a CO2 chamber. And so, like I said, you never know what these guys are going to do. And like I said, it runs the gamut. And there is no regulation. And even where there is regulation, it doesn't cover things like euthanasia. And euthanasia, of course, is a Greek term meaning good death. And I would say that that's very rarely used in the industry. Matter of fact, our state symposium that they just had for wildlife control here, we had a whole panel on euthanasia. And what the guys complain about is they can't use good humane techniques because when you're out in the field, you can't do that. And so what is the best way to do it? And so they range from everything from killing skunks by injection of acetone in the chest to drowning to cervical dislocation to blunt force trauma and things like that, which are not typically considered humane, but that's the best they can do because they're out in the field. And, of course, when they do this, they're killing healthy animals. It's not like it's an injured animal. It's a healthy animal. They just want to dispose of it rather than relocate it.
And in those kinds of scenarios, Jack, is that just, sort of just the path of least resistance and sort of, exalted laziness, or is it just chasing the dollar or both? I mean,
it's a combination. It's chasing the dollar. A lot of them think that it's good science. And, yeah, it was good science back in the early 1900s, but we've learned a lot since then. And like I say, a lot of them deny it. Because, I mean, even at some of the meetings I've gone to with these guys, I'll bring up new science ideas, and they reject it. Like an example is drowning. It's been determined that drowning is not humane. And a lot of the local guys have told me that, well, drowning is humane because traditionally they've always done it and it works just fine. And so they totally reject new science. And
wow.
See that all the time.
Yeah.
Not just with the trappers, but fish and game departments do the same thing. They just reject sound science because they're making money.
Right. And it sounds like it's just a lot easier to look the other way and not really even, ponder what may have been discovered or.
Well, like I said, it doesn't fit their agenda. It's inconvenient.
Right. Wow. All right. Well, this is Talking Animals. If you just tuned in, I'm speaking with Jack Murphy of Urban Wildlife Rescue. If you'd like to ask Jack a question or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663 or email dj@wmnf.org. So Jack, let's make this a little more specific and possibly at least a little more positive. So let's say a raccoon turns up at my house, which has happened, and it's not just sort of fleeting. It seems like to be hanging around. What should I do? Let's say that, either I live where you are or you live, or operate where I am. And so I call you. What take me through the steps of what would happen and what should happen in the good version of the story.
Okay, well, the first thing I do is would ask you, what is the raccoon doing? I I mean, if he's just hanging around in the yard, then there's obviously something in the yard that's attracting him. It would most likely be food or shelter of some sort. Depending on the time of year, which down where you're at, it would be a moot point because, like, for instance, a raccoon, here they give birth in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
Down there they give birth year-round. And so that presents a whole different problem, you know?
Sure.
But, you know, so I would definitely check to see if it was a female with young, if it was here and it was in the spring. And other than that, I would try and figure out why the animal was hanging out there. You know, here, especially in late summer, I'll get a lot of calls from people where they have a raccoon hanging around, and you find out they got a fish pond filled with koi, and they've got a grape arbor with grapes. And it's like, okay, that raccoon could live there for the rest of his life and have everything he needs.
Yeah, so, yeah, he's just smart enough
you know,
to have...
So sometimes slight habitat modification. Sometimes there are devices, scare tactics that can be used. There's motion-activated sprinklers that can scare away an animal that would keep them away if there is an attractant. Sometimes removing the attractant would be good. You know, and then I would also check to see if the animal is living in or under the structure. So if the animal's living in the roof of the house, then I don't trap the animal and relocate the animal. I simply get the animal out, and the animal can go wherever he wants. And again, using modern science, we know now that raccoons within their territory have usually a minimum of 19 or 20 den sites within their area, their territory. And so when you kick the animal out, yeah, they'll be a little irritated, but we all have a bad day, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so they just simply move to one of their other places, and that's the end of it.
So the guy, the hypothetical raccoon that's showed up at my house, so, you know, you get him out, and he's a little mad and whatever, but because he has, you know, maybe 18, 19 other den sites, the idea is that... that he will just go to one of those. And so the fact that he showed up, you know, a few days ago, that's enough to keep him from sort of showing up a few days from now.
And he might show up again.
Yeah.
You know, but it's one of those kind of things where I tell people, you know, if you're living on planet Earth and expect not to have some kind of interaction with wildlife, then you're on the wrong planet. You know, I mean, if the animal's causing no harm, then why bother? You know,
right.
And again, you know, it's up to, because some people, they're adamant. I get people that call me up and they want me to come out and kill anything that's got fur on it. And I will not do that, you know. And so, you know, most of the time, I mean, the animal's going to be where it is for a specific reason. And so most of the time, that's either going to be food or shelter, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you change that, modify that, do something so the animal will not want to be there, then they're just simply not going to show up.
Okay, and on the other hand, back to sort of the other approach, the not so good approach. So if someone did come along and I wasn't smart enough to have you come help me with this raccoon thing, someone else came along that was a wildlife control operator, and they, let's just say even that they didn't, you know, kill this raccoon, but they just took it somewhere else and relocated it. If it was beyond where those 19 den sites, let's say, might be, then that animal is, like, out of luck.
Yeah. Basically, you know, there's been studies on some animals, and that's why I say, you know, in the last 50 or 20 years, there's been scientists that have studied the animals traditionally called varmints, you know, whether it's skunks or raccoons or foxes, coyotes, you know, things like that. And raccoon studies, there's been several of them, main one being done in Illinois, and the survival rate is right around 25%. And I know the scientist that did at least finish the study, and he said that most of the animals that died, died en route to the point of origin. So in other words, you take the animal out, you let it go, and they fight for their life to try and get back to where they came from, because that's what they know. And most of them don't make it.
Wow.
So once we started seeing these stats 15, 20 years ago, because I'll admit, back when we first started, I had nothing to go by. I mean, I had nothing to follow. All I knew is that they were trapping them and killing them, so I was trapping them and relocating them. And then once I started finding this stuff out, I went, uh-oh, not good. There's got to be a better way. And then I started getting into exclusion using one-way doors and things of that sort.
Yeah. And another thing, too, that you know, again, until you know, you're either faced with this problem or you know, stumble across, you know, great information on your website or Facebook page or other people, again, that are doing, you know, kind of doing things the way that you do them, or, again, a show like this, hopefully, is that you just don't think about, again, the implications, like on the raccoon story, again, you know, that raccoon that turns up and suddenly, you know, I see a raccoon, as you kind of alluded to, but I think a larger point of being relocated is that raccoon might be a mom raccoon.
That's right.
That's got babies at that one of those den sites or somewhere that maybe, you know, moved into your house or somewhere, right, to keep them. So again, you move mom out somewhere or something worse happens to mom, and then those babies are doomed.
Right. We get that every year. Again, as a rehabilitator, I mean, last year, I'm trying to think, I think we rehabilitated, it's around 160 baby raccoons, and a good portion of them were orphaned either from a homeowner with a trap or from a trapper. And, you know, people go out and trap the animal, and then 2 or 3 days later, they hear all this screaming going on in the attic or out in the shed and go out there and find the babies.
Wow.
We get that every year. And I say, oh, probably 75% of the orphaned animals that most rehabilitators get are a result of trapping in one way or another.
All right. Well, let's try to work in. We have a new, I guess, sort of phone system. So the folks that are calling normally, their calls we automatically answer. I'm going to try to get those if I can. But here's some emails that have come in meanwhile, starting with, hi, I love squirrels. However, recently they invaded our barn to eat our horse feed. Horse feed was then placed in thick rubber bins. The squirrels started eating through the bin lids. Why would they eat rubber, and wouldn't that make them sick?
No. You know, what they need to do is use metal. For animals, I would definitely use metal, especially squirrels. I had the same thing here. One time I was getting a lot of donated bread, and I threw it in the trash can, and the squirrels just ate holes through the trash can. I would suggest on something like that, putting the food into metal containers, because once they have discovered that there's food in the barn, they're going to keep coming for food in the barn. You know, they're just like we are. Once you discover that the grocery store down the street's got good food, you keep going to that grocery store, you know? And so I would definitely use metal containers rather than rubber.
Okay, well, that's a good tip. Let's see if we can get one of our callers involved here. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Jack Murphy.
Can you hear me, Jack?
Yes.
Okay, you mentioned this was a business for you. I was wondering how much you charged for getting rid of specifically raccoons, because I have an experience with that here at my house.
Well, I don't get rid of anything. All I do is would figure out getting them to move. What are they doing around your house?
Well, one night my little granddaughter was staying over, and she came in screaming, and she was hearing these noises up in the ceiling. So basically, the raccoon had relocated to my attic and had babies there.
Oh, okay. Yeah, see, in a situation like that, there's a couple of options, and one would be typically a raccoon, when she has the young, she will keep the young in the birth den until they reach the age where she decides to wean them. And once she weans them, she'll take them out and start to teach them how to get around in the world. And so one option is to wait until she moves the babies out and then seal up the place where she got into so it doesn't happen again. And then usually if I get involved, what I do is I come out, and I have several different methods I use to just try and get the mom to move and take the babies with her. And so then, of course, once that's done, then the area where they're getting in has to be sealed up. As far as cost goes, that varies. I assume you're down in Florida?
Yeah, I'm in South St. Petersburg.
Yeah, okay. See, I'm in Colorado. And so, you know, my charges up here, you know, kind of vary. To come out and try and evict the mom and give her the boot and get her to take the babies with her, usually looking at around $200.
And also, Jack, thanks so much, caller, for your call. And this actually might tie into one of the emails that just came in, Jack. One of them, this one says, how does a homeowner find a humane wildlife control operator, which may or may not be, you know, contradictory from what you've explained, but I think we know what they mean. And how can you make sure they are actually humane?
Yeah, that is a tough thing to do. There is a website that's got some good information on that. It's called Total Wildlife Control, and he is a humane wildlife control operator in Oklahoma, and he's got some good info on his website of what you can look for. I do believe the Humane Society of the United States also has some information on that on their website as well. You know, talking to him, there's not very many good ones in the country. Most of us that are doing it have kind of talked with each other, and we kind of know who we are, and when I say a handful, it's a handful. There's probably not much more than 20, 25 of us throughout the entire country that do totally humane, non-lethal wildlife control. And we're growing. I mean, you know, 20 years ago, there was me and one or two other people. Now it's growing, you know. So it does work. That's why I say it's way more efficient. Also, a lot cheaper than trapping. People don't realize, too, the cost of trapping. The guy's got to come out every day for weeks picking up animals and traps. And I go out twice, once to you know, maybe put a one-way door on the second time to seal up the hole, you know. And so, you know, that's basically that.
Okay. So really, it's tricky, and I guess you can just try to ask the best questions possible.
Yeah.
And it also sounds like, from what you've already told us, that it's unlikely that there are going to be, you know, a widening number of people that do it the way that you and precious few others do it, just because it sounds like the other way is far more lucrative.
Well, it is more lucrative, you know, and even those guys, they have their slow seasons. Like, I know one of the guys here, he told me that if it wasn't for pocket gophers, he'd go out of business, because when it's slow, he can go out and poison and kill pocket gophers, you know, and prairie dogs, things like that. And so, you know, it is a seasonal business, especially here. Down there, it might be a little different because it's warm year-round. But,
sure.
You know, basically, it is lucrative, and it is a growing business. I mean, it is a growing business because, you know, the cities are all continuing to grow and get bigger. And like I say, the animals are moving to the cities because we're making better habitat, and they want to live here, and they want the food, water, and shelter, too, you know.
Sure.
So it's a weird thing, but my whole thing is we need to learn to live with them to a degree. I mean, you don't want them living in your house or necessarily under your shed or in your barn, things like that. Those things we can deal with, but
yeah.
Trapping and killing the animal, to me, that's a little extreme.
Okay, cool. Let's see if we can take another caller. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Jack Murphy.
Hi, my name's Renee. I'm calling from, I used to live in South St. Petersburg, where my neighbor became good friends with a family of raccoons, and we all had dogs that ran around on the water without leashes, and we all had cats that were indoor, outdoor, and everybody seemed to get along just fine, so I just
that's
like
great.
To say that.
Yeah, that's great.
Although a few times I was out early in the morning, and the raccoons froze in my front yard like statues, and I thought I was on hallucinogenics for a second, but
yeah.
I was calling because also in South St. Petersburg, more close to, and Jack, you're probably not familiar with this area, but Fort DeSoto, the Sierra Verde area, there's a lot of golf courses and disgusting condos, and about a year and a half ago, I was driving down the main strip, and I saw this huge, beautiful coyote just dart across the street, and me being an animal lover, I stupidly, you know, pulled over, and I followed it up through the golf course, and we were only about 20 feet away, and I was lucky enough to just sit there with it, and of course, a couple months later, I saw it dead on the interstate, and I honestly thought that you were local until I just heard you were in Colorado, but I don't know, do you have any bright ideas for coyotes in urban settings other than killings? I mean, they have very bright ideas, but people seem so fearful and you know.
Yeah,
thanks for your call. Go ahead, Jack.
Right. Yeah, the urban coyote issue is a biggie right now nationwide. I mean, you know, I spoke at the coyote conference here in Colorado a couple of years ago. We've had a big problem, for lack of a better word, with urban coyotes here. They've killed people's dogs and cats and things like that, and the occasional nip on a human. But the thing is that the coyotes have now learned that they can live in the cities. And coyotes are a good example of what they call compensatory rebound, and this happens with all animals. You know, it's kind of a thing as predation rises, the birth rates increase. And so if you start trapping squirrels, then they're going to basically start to have more babies because they're going to make up for that difference. All living things do that. You got a tree, you want it to grow bigger, you cut it back. You have an animal population, you want it to grow bigger, you cut it back. That's the same principle that our departments of fish and game use with their deer and their elk. You know, they allow certain hunting and so many females and males to be taken in each section, thereby ensuring they're going to breed and have more animals to shoot next year, and they call that wildlife management. And so with coyotes, like when I started the coyote conference, I started out by saying that the United States government, Department of Agriculture, Wildlife Services, they kill, at the conference I said, 100,000 coyotes a year, and they've been doing that for about 85 years. But I was corrected by the local Wildlife Services guy who told me I was a little rough on them because they've reduced that. Now they only kill about 85,000 coyotes a year in the western states for ranchers, and we pay for that to the tune of $126 million a year. And so they've been doing that for 85 years. On top of that, you got varmint hunters, they shoot coyotes, and you got ranchers that shoot coyotes. So let's just make a rough estimate and say 150,000, 200,000 coyotes a year are killed in the western states. So we don't have a coyote problem now, do we? And I just wait for the laughter to die down.
Yeah.
We do. And so killing coyotes doesn't work. Coyotes originally lived in 9 states west of the Mississippi River. They now live in all of North America. So they've expanded their range to the entire continent because we've been trying to kill them off. And so that's a perfect example of compensatory rebound right there. And the coyote is a tough animal to deal with because they're smarter than we are. So I'm not going to get rid of them. I need to learn how to live with them.
Yeah. Boy, it sounds really complicated, though.
It is.
Yeah.
It is. So, well, it's really very simple. We make it complicated.
Okay. You know? Yeah. All right. Yeah. No, the animals have it all well in hand. It's us humans that seem to be screwing it up. So
this is
Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. I'm speaking with Jack Murphy, co-founder and director of Urban Wildlife Rescue. And we just have a few minutes left, but we invite you, if you'd like, to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663 or emailing dj@wmnf.org. And Jack's website is urbanwildliferescue.org, and they're also on Facebook at that same name. So let's take a couple more of the questions that have sort of poured in by email. One is probably a little bit outside your purview, I think, because you sounded like it was chiefly small mammals that you deal with. But let's see. This one says, the subject heading is bees, and then it says, can they be relocated?
For bees?
Yeah.
They can be relocated.
Okay.
They can, and I don't do bees.
Okay.
Oh, I know beekeepers that do them and, you know, things like that. And yes, they can be relocated.
Okay, cool. And then we got another one here with subject heading as squirrels. Moved into my house many years ago. Many trees around squirrels thought they were cute and fed corn cobs, peanuts, etc. Now they are past making un-something house, disturbing potted plants, etc. Relocated many to nearby woods, but always more to come. Any recommendations for permanent fix? And it sounds like exactly the phenomenon that you just explained, but
right.
you take it, Jack, because you're the expert.
On that, you know, first thing you need to start with is habitat modification. You know, what are the squirrels getting into? Change it, move it, stop doing it, whatever, and stop trapping them. Because, again, you know, like, try and explain the way that compensatory rebound would work on something like a squirrel. And you see it more on squirrels because they're diurnal. They're awake during the day. You don't see it as much with skunks or raccoons because they're nocturnal and you don't see them that often. But, you know, squirrels are very territorial. And so within their territory, you know, there's so many squirrels. And usually just going to be one. And so when you start trapping squirrels, you open up territories for other squirrels. So you've just created vacancy, the old term nature abhors a vacuum. You've just created a vacancy. And so now all the squirrels in the area have more room, and they also have more food. So they might as well party and make more babies, which they will do. And they'll quickly fill up what happened. And so, you know, I get calls all the time where people say, you know, we've been trapping squirrels for 15 years. 15 years ago, we were catching 5 and 6 a year. Now we're catching 50. What do we do? And the first thing you got to do is quit trapping. And habitat modification, fix the problems. If they're getting into the roof of the house, fix the hole. I talked to a lady a few months ago, and she told me her husband was trapping squirrels for 8 years because they kept getting into their roof. And I said, did you ever patch a hole? And she said, no. And I told her, well, you'll be trapping squirrels till you die. And even after you die, the squirrels will still be in the roof. You know, you need to fix the holes, you know?
Yeah.
And so that's the main thing. I would start with basically habitat modification of some sort. Like you say, they're getting into the plants. Well, you've created a problem by feeding them and doing the things that you've already done. You've created a problem. You might have to move those potted plants. You might have to put them indoors for a while or put screening around them or do something along those lines until this batch of squirrels realizes they can't do that.
Sure.
And then once things balance out, and that might take a while, could take anywhere from a few months to a year or two, but once things balance out, you should be okay. But to continue trapping, the problem's just going to continue and probably could get worse over the course of the next few years.
Great. Thanks, Jack. Okay, we just have about a minute or so left. And let me ask you, too, because we've sort of addressed around this, or at least I have, but let's just talk a moment about so-called humane traps, which I gather in this world is often a grim misnomer, really.
Yeah, to me, no trap is humane.
Mm-hmm.
The old idea of the little cage trap, you catch them in a little cage, and you take them out and let them go. Any animal, no matter what the trap is, you know, like people call a leg hold trap, a foothold trap, humane, or a live trap. And it is. You catch the animal alive, and he's not going anywhere until the trapper comes out and kills him, you know?
Yeah.
But in the meantime, they're in pain. But I've also seen animals in live traps get beat up really, really bad trying to get out. I've seen them where they bust their face all up trying to get out, bust their arms all up trying to get out. I've seen circumstances where trappers will use babies to try and lure a mother out. They go up into an attic and they pull all the babies out, but mom runs off. And so they take the babies and they put them in a cage next to a trap, and the mom literally ripped the baby's legs off trying to pull it into the trap with her after she's caught, you know, and things like that. And so a live trap is no more humane than a leg hold trap. And then, of course, you got the other body gripping traps, which are designed, you know, a snare, which is designed to strangle the animal. The others, like the Kuro or the Conibear trap, which is designed to break their neck. if it doesn't work, it breaks their back, and they sit there and suffer until they die. And so trapping in general is just really an antiquated way of dealing with animals. Like I say, you know, we've made all these advancements in the last 100 years, and we still deal with wildlife the same way we did back in the 1800s, and it's time for that to change.
All right, Jack. Well, I think we're just about out of time. Let me see if we can squeeze in one quick phone call. Hi, you're on with Jack Murphy. If you have a quick question for Jack.
Am I on?
Yes. Hi. We have just maybe 30 seconds or so left for a question for Jack. Yeah.
Real quick. We got an armadillo in the backyard outside of St. Pete, Seminole, Florida. And he's not causing any problems or anything. I'm just curious as to why he's there. I mean, he's got dug holes under the fence to go between yards. Why?
You know, I don't know. Sometimes it's hard to figure out why they do what they do. And unfortunately, I was waiting for a question on a species that we don't have here. I don't have armadillos here, and I've never dealt with one. The only time I've seen them is when I drove down through Arizona and saw them dead on the road. So I've never really dealt with armadillos, but there's something there that's attracting them, and I don't know what that is. It could be, you know, a large insect population in the soil. I'm not sure what would attract an armadillo, to be perfectly honest about it.
Well, I did see him one night a couple nights ago, and I went out with a flashlight because I heard, the rustling through the bushes, and he was just, I saw him, I shined a light, and he froze and looked at me and just real easily turned around and walked through the hole over to the other yard.
It's not a problem. Since I don't deal with him here and I've never really dealt with one, I'm not really sure why he would be there, but there's obviously something attracting him there.
Yeah, right. Same basic principles probably apply that you've explained to us. Yeah. So thanks for your call, sir.
Sure.
All right, Jack. Well, gosh, thank you so much. We are out of time, but again, we've been speaking with Jack Murphy from Urban Wildlife Rescue. His website is urbanwildliferescue.org. They're also on Facebook by that same name. And again, one of the resources, you can go there, and I'm sure probably get some more information, some questions answered. And then if you have specific geographic kind of needs that Jack can't maybe address, sounded like a good resource was totalwildlifecontrol.com. Did I get that right, Jack?
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
You can also email me, too, from the website, and if I can help anybody, I will do my best to do that too.
That's terrific. Well, gosh, I think we've all learned a lot here, Jack, and I really, really appreciate it. And keep up your good work. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you, Duncan. Appreciate it.
All right, thank you.
All right, bye.
All right, in just a few minutes, we'll speak with Julie Watkins of the Girls Gone Green about the No Meat to March extravaganza she's launched in conjunction here in Tampa with Florida Voices for Animals, including a Tampa screening March 23rd of Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home, the acclaimed documentary. At the moment, let's step into the Talking Animals Comedy Corner with a very brief piece today. This is Dimitri Martin with a bit called Dalmatians on today's Comedy Corner on Talking Animals.
When a Dalmatian sees a cow, he must be like, what the hell happened to him? He looks so fat and smeary. Am I high right now? Wow. The cow looks at the Dalmatian. He must be like, he looks amazing. I gotta get in shape. My tits are on the ground here.
All right, that was Dimitri Martin with a piece called Dalmatians, taken from his album Stand Up Comedian. All right, to find out a bit about No Meat March and some of its events, including the March 23rd screening locally of the acclaimed documentary Peaceable Kingdom, The Journey Home, let's welcome Julie Watkins to Talking Animals. Good morning, Julie.
Hey, good morning, Duncan. Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Thanks for joining us. So I feel like we have a ton of information to try to shoehorn into just a few minutes, but I think if we talk really fast like that, we can probably do it. So,
good. I'm a fast talker.
Okay,
so
me too. Cool. Okay, let's maybe, if you wouldn't mind, just so we have more context, just briefly outline what the Girls Gone Green is, and then we'll go from there.
Okay, well, it is a Florida-based, more specifically Jacksonville-based nonprofit, and we focus on exploring environmental, animal, and health issues, because we obviously think they're all tied together. So we try to reach people where they're at. Maybe they want to do better for the environment. Maybe they want to do better by animals, or maybe they just want to improve their health. So we try to help them along the way, basically. We do events and campaigns. We host a Veg Fest in Jacksonville. And our other big event is, of course, the No Meat March, which is centered more around health. But as you know, improves the environment and really helps the animals in turn, too.
All right. So then I think that's our cue to get right into telling us a little bit more about No Meat March and how it works and what sort of the objective is beyond what you've just touched on.
Right. Well, it started about, this is our third one. So okay. It started over 2 years ago. And we just invite people to try to go meat-free for 31 days because we feel like in order to get a good idea of what it means to you know, kind of thrive on a meatless diet, give your body a chance to experiment with that and see how you feel, see if you see, you know, notice any improvements, any kind of health improvements. So it's just a great way to invite people to do that. And then on top of that, which is really good, and what we really notice how people sign up is if they know someone who's already meat-free, it gives them a reason then to kind of say, yeah, okay, I'll do it, where otherwise they probably wouldn't. You know, like they, right. Now they've got an actual date to start, a date to finish, and they're going to have just huge community support because you try to make it fun.
Yeah.
We send out daily emails, just jam-packed full of information with recipes, resources, all the events that we're hosting. We get discounts from around town from the restaurants and businesses who also participate. And what's also great is a lot of businesses will expand their vegan or vegetarian menu for the month and call it their No Meat March menu. And we've gotten several restaurants on board to do that. And then this year, this is the first time we launched it in Tampa and also Orlando, Daytona Beach. So when you sign up, you get access to everything happening in all those cities. You can go to any event, get any discount anywhere. And we're just trying to build it and make it bigger and bigger so people can do it from anywhere. Even though they can do it from anywhere right now,
sure.
We'd like to have it where it's personal in
right.
their city.
Well, a couple things, too, that you mentioned, Julie. One is that the thing you mentioned earlier about you know when you're going to finish. But I guess we should hasten to add, since it's, you know, March 6th, that it's totally fine to start March 6th or March 7th. It's not like, oh, my gosh, I missed the chance to do this. You can jump right in today or tomorrow, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we've had people over the years who sign up March 30th to March 31st. And and even beyond that, really. But I notice some people who will, they'll do it March 3rd, but then they'll just take it through April 3rd.
Sure.
So, you know,
yeah.
They'll do their own 30 or 31 days. But you're right. Jump in anytime because, if anything, you're just going to get discounts at least and then get the email and get all the recipes if that's what you've been looking for, too. So.
And let me address the email because it also hooks into an email that just came into the studio just now, which says, I attended the No Meat March kickoff dinner in Tampa at Mellow Mushroom. It was great. I've been to your website and clicked on the Tampa discounts, but there aren't any. Where can I find this info? And it seems like, from what I've been able to see, that the emails that you, when you sign up for No Meat March, you get these daily emails, which are just jam-packed with info and discounts and coupons and cool little tidbits and trinkets.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And you know what? This is a call to action to Tampa then, because you're right. We did not get a lot of response, I should say, from restaurants that wanted to participate and offer a discount. So it's also, you know, the Girls Gone Green, we're volunteer-based. We still have full-time jobs, but we're, you know, so this is done in our free time.
Sure.
So if anyone would also like to help and, you know, and set up some of these restaurants and businesses or help us expand or just jump in, we'd love that, too. That would be huge for us.
Sure.
But yeah, we did get a lot in Jacksonville. We got a good amount in Orlando and Daytona Beach. Their business has really stepped up, too, in offering the discount. So.
Okay, Julie, well, gosh, we're sort of nearing the finish line here, so we got to keep talking fast. But one thing we should be sure to mention that I've alluded to earlier is among the kind of things that are part of this is the emails and the great treats and discounts and suggestions, et cetera, and just the support. But also there's events, too. So let's talk a little bit about the Peaceable Kingdom screening.
Yeah, Tampa, I tell you one thing, Tampa has a ton of events. Isabel from Florida Voices for Animals has really put together some nice stuff that's going to be happening throughout the month. So the screening of Peaceable Kingdom, wonderful. Like I say, throughout the No Meat March, it's also meeting people where they are. So we try to do health-related movies, environmental-related movies, and Peaceable Kingdom, you know, kind of having a little bit more of an impact for the animals. And just kind of, you know, knowing where your food's coming from. That's what the whole No Meat March is about, is just building a conscious community of eaters. So you know exactly, you know, because sometimes people get in their habits and they do become mindless eaters. And they're just used to ordering what they order. So for No Meat March, it's kind of like a reboot button for you and your system. And now you're putting a little bit more thought into it, and you're exploring your food a little bit more. You're learning about it. So hosting these events in the cities are crucial in order to bring people, you know, kind of along the way and help to keep them motivated throughout the month as well.
Yeah.
So we just feel like at the end of the 31 days, you know, you're going to feel something.
Sure.
And we've got a lot of positive feedback of people who have even said that we've saved their lives because of it, because it's really helped to kind of open their minds and the door to a vegetarian diet.
And again, it's really cool and helpful. I mean, just again, the emails are so, I mean, the fact that they're daily and they're this comprehensive is really impressive, because what I'm just looking at, you know, and I'm sure they're all this way, you know, gives you like breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and then gives you the specifics. And the thing I'm looking at is puffy pillow pancakes for breakfast, a rustic tomato rice kale soup for lunch, and a vegan mac and cheese for dinner. It's like, well, geez, well, I can do this. But let me quickly hit the specifics of the Peaceful Kingdom screening. We have a little more time, a couple more Wednesdays to come back to that. But it is, again, so this is a acclaimed documentary. It's going to screen Saturday, March 23rd at 3 p.m. at Jan Kaminis. I hope that's how you pronounce it. Platte Regional. I'm not from around here. Platte Regional Library, and that's on 3910 South, I think Manhattan Avenue, Tampa. I can't even read my own writing. But anyways, that's also available on Florida Voices for Animals website and on their meetup and other stuff. So, and again, we'll talk about that between now and the screening again. So, gosh, this is so great, Julie. Thank you so much. I think we managed to cram most of it, if not all of it, into our little allotted time. So very good.
I think so. And you know what? The rest of it's on our website. So
right.
You can check that out. And
it's nomeatmarch.com. And again, also on Facebook under the same name. So all the information is there for the taking. So. Cool.
Great.
Thank you, Julie. Really appreciate it. All right. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Okay. So I'm Duncan Strauss. Towards the end of the show, we'll play Name That Animal Tune. We're getting close to the end of the show, actually. But the winner will, win a pair of tickets to see Get the Let Out, a Led Zeppelin tribute band performing March 16th at the Straz Center. That's happening in a few minutes here on Talk Animals. Right now, let's do some animal news and announcements. And again, The winter fun drive concluded last Wednesday, and then the Wednesday before, we sought your support for Talking Animals and WMNF, and as I alluded to at the top of the show, pleased to report we met our goal and, in fact, landed a good distance beyond that. So a big thank you to all who supported us. It means a great deal to me. Thank you. And still, the station fell a bit short of its goal overall for the fun drive. So especially if you didn't have an opportunity to pledge during the fun drive, I invite you to visit WMNF.org and donate what you can. And that would be terrific. Thank you. Thank you. So a couple of quick things here. Sort of local, at least Florida. They make quite the fearsome threesome. Mary Lee, Jeannie, and now Lydia, the third massive great white shark tagged and tracked recently by OSearch scientists. ABC4 in Jacksonville, Florida, reports that the nonprofit shark research group OSearch caught Lydia Sunday near the Mayport Poles surfing area in Jacksonville, weighing in at 2,000 pounds and measuring 14.5 feet long. Lydia wasted no time in clamping her jaws on a chum line, then dragging the boat into reverse before the scientists gained control, according to ABC4. Once the animal was secured, OSearch researched, stapled a GPS device to her fin, took blood samples, did an ultrasound to detect any pregnancy, she's not, and eased her back into the water. OSearch wrote on its expedition blog that Lydia is named after Bradley University founder Lydia Moss Bradley, a longtime friend of OSearch sponsor Caterpillar Inc. So there you go with that. And coming up tomorrow from Pet Animal Shelter, some Yappy Hour action. Positively Pooch Pot, Posh Pooch, sorry, I got that reversed. Positively Posh Pooch, say that three times fast or one time slow even. And that's going to be at 1425 4th Street North in St. Pete. And that's from 5 to 8 p.m. And get your pooches glammed up and ready for poshing. While you're enjoying wine, snacks, and other furry-friendly company, you can visit Positively, that's P-A-W, of course, positivelyposhpooch.com for more information. And, of course, looking ahead a little bit, Animal Coalition of Tampa is holding its 6th annual Spaghetti and No Balls Dinner Saturday, March 30th from 5 to 9 p.m. at the Yuengling Breweries in North Tampa, North Street, sorry, 30th in Tampa. And all kinds of cool things happening there, and we'll probably speak with Linda a little bit about that before that event rolls around. But you can find out a lot more by just going to actampa.org. And that might be all we have time for at the moment. So, anyways, I am Duncan Strauss. You're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. This is a giveaway. You do not need to be a WMNF member to win, and there will be a prize. The winner, again, will win a pair of tickets to see Led Zeppelin tribute band Get the Lead Out performing March 16th at the Straz Center. To the first person who calls in the correct title of this animal song, to 813-239-9663, it's Name That Animal Tune. I'm Talking Animals.
Hey, mama said the way you move gonna make you sweat, gonna make you groove.
All right, not surprisingly, perhaps, all the phone lines are lit. Let's take them in the order they can. Hi, you're on Talking Animals. Can you name that animal tune?
Is that Black Dog?
It sure is.
Yay.
I hope that wasn't too hard. It's for a Led Zeppelin thing. Come on. All right, what's your first name?
Margo.
Okay, I'll come back and get your information, get you set up to go see Get the Lead Out March 16th at the Straz Center. Thanks for listening. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, we do have a winner, Margo, as you know. So, we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. We'll be back next Wednesday, March 13th at 9 a.m. I hope you'll join me then. I also hope you visit our website, our fab new website, with a searchable database of all our shows since 2003. Please check it out at talkinganimals.net. And there's archives, podcasts, the whole nine yards. We also have a link there to the Talking Animals Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. So again, talkinganimals.net for that. Talking Animals broadcast. I am trying to go too fast. Outreach consultant and Jill of all trades is Olivia Busalis. My thanks to her. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. We're closing out today's show with an animal song from Lou Reed, who not only is a rock and roll great and whose birthday was Saturday, but is also married to the also great Lori Anderson, who was a guest a few years back on Talking Animals. By absolutely no one's request, I'd like to recreate what happened when I called for that phone interview with Lori Anderson, and Lou Reed answered. Hello? Hi, this is Duncan Strauss. I have a live radio interview scheduled with Lori. Lori! That's it. This is Lou Reed with Animal Language, taking us up to the NPR News on WMNF Tampa. Brandon, Weeki Watch and Beyond. Thanks for listening. Speak with you again next Wednesday at 9 a.m. on Talking Animals. Thanks.
This Riley had a dog. She used to keep it in her backyard.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown.